Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts Community of Christ offers for today's world.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Project Zion podcast. This is your host, Robin Linkhart, and we're here to explore some exciting topics. Today, we're here with Megan Olson from Salt Lake City, Utah, and we are going to explore the topic of restoration history and culture and so much more. So welcome, Megan. We're glad to have you today. And why don't you just jump right in and tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're living, what you do, and so forth.
Yeah, I do a little bit of everything. I'm an adjunct instructor of English at Weber State University in Ogden, Utah. I live in Salt Lake. So I commute if I'm teaching face-to-face. Right now I'm teaching online, and it's been that way for a couple months or a couple semesters. And I also substitute teach, which is really exciting. It's kind of this temporary job that's turned into a 3-year stint. And I also work at Boys and Girls Club, counseling with kids there. And I do a little bit of freelance writing. Right. So I grew up LDS, and I was an Army brat. We moved all over the place. So I didn't really have a very typical childhood in the LDS church, as a lot of people do. I experienced a lot of different cultures and a lot of different placed congregations. And typically, one of the things that Mormons will like to say is that anywhere you go in the world, the congregations are the same. And unfortunately, that's kind of true. People tend to disperse from Utah and mix in with congregations, and they sort of do this thing where they conform everybody else to the Utah way of thinking and the Utah way of life. And I saw this on my mission especially. I served an LDS mission from 2012 to 2013 in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. I was mostly in New Orleans, though. The headquarters of that mission are in Baton Rouge. And there are several wards out there, congregations that are very culturally Utah Mormon-esque, except for the New Orleans First Ward where I served, which was as oddball an LDS congregation as you'll ever find. And I loved it. And it really shaped the way that I saw, or the way that I experience spirit and community. So that, I mean, maybe that's a story for another time, but yeah, that's a little bit about me.
Mm-hmm. And so currently I understand you're a member of Community of Christ and attend the Salt Lake
yes.
City congregation.
Yes.
And just briefly, when did you join the church?
That was March 19th, 2017.
So I want our listeners to know that Megan actually is in our lineup for two other interviews on Project Zion podcast. So you'll want to watch for those. One is our Fair Trade series where folks talk about faith transitions. And the other is Chai Can't Even, which is focused on millennials sharing their stories and perspectives on faith and our world today. So Megan, I understand that you have a keen interest in restoration history, as well as some fascinating interests that you have studied in your graduate studies, and things that you would like to continue to research and study. So tell us a little bit about your master's, what your focus was, and what areas of study or research you're really kind of wanting to go deeper in into the future.
Yeah, I have a master's degree in English from Utah State University. I went to the University of Utah for my bachelor's, and I have almost 3 bachelor's there. I got my bachelor's in theater production and design, and then started pursuing a bachelor's in ancient history and classical languages, and figured, wait a second, I could just take my bachelor's that I already have and go ahead and start a master's program. So I was going to go into folklore. It's an emphasis within the English department at Utah State. And I was going to look at how apotheosis happens on a folkloric level, how it comes up from the grassroots, and we sort of create our own gods and by exaggerating people's stories and history and basically building faith and religion from there. Because I find that the formation of religion is very fascinating, which is why I'm pretty interested in restoration studies. Not only is it my history and my heritage, I always like to study things from my own. That's something that I grew up with. And that's, there's a term in folklore called emic and edic. There are two terms. So from an emic perspective, a folklorist is looking at their own culture from where they grew up. And an edic is an outsider looking in at a culture they're not related, they don't relate to. And I prefer the emic approach. There are pros and cons to both approaches, but I prefer the emic approach just because I know what to look for in studying different groups. So I wanted to look at that in the formation of religion and use Joseph Smith as sort of a case study and really write a thesis about that in within folklore. I ended up doing something completely different as requested by my thesis chair because she wasn't jiving with some of the things that I was talking about or wanting to talk about. So I wrote my thesis on something that still interests me, digital culture and internet culture, because as a teenager, I was definitely trolling to forums is what we, how we say it, I guess. We write it out though, so it doesn't sound as ridiculous. but I mean, I grew up on memes. I grew up on different cartoons and podcasts and conversations that were happening long before viral videos were really a thing on YouTube. I don't think YouTube was even a thing yet when I was looking at, you know, involved in internet culture. So I wrote my thesis on digital culture and how memes actually have played a part in this resurgence of racism that we see offline, in the offline world, and ideas about race and how that's perpetuated very blackface Jim Crow-ish online. But it's really unrelated to what I'm really interested in, which is religion, history, culture, and American religious history in particular. I'm not just interested in Mormonism or Restoration. I'm also interested in Shakers and Utopianism in 19th century the United States.
So it sounds like the Second Great Awakening period of the 19th century holds a lot of interest for you.
Yeah. And in part, it's because that's sort of the catalyst for something that's been happening ever since. Because, of course, in the 20th century, you get a lot of cults coming up, and they get even worse, like much worse. I mean, in the 19th century, you have this experimentation with sex and the family structure and communalism. In the 20th century, you get a lot of that sex too, but there's also a bit of violence that's happening, and it's just getting more intense, I think. And the expectations of devotion are far more intense. So it's something that I think you can see it in medieval Europe in a lot of ways, with aestheticism and self-flagellation and stuff like that. But it's fun and it's not fun, but it's interesting to study it as it's happened more recently, because this is still stuff that we have a lot more access to, as far as information and firsthand accounts and narrative. And it's still fresh in our minds. I mean, if you go outside and not in Utah, but if you were to go outside in the United States anywhere and say, I'm a Mormon, somebody's going to ask you, bound to ask you if how many wives or how many moms you have. So that's still very fresh, that sense of cultiness, and especially with Scientology and Leah Remini, what's going on there, there's an interest in that that the American public has and always really has had.
That is fascinating. I can see how your interest has really been, in a sense, a passion and just a desire to kind of dig in and learn more about this. And I love that way you talk about history and the comparison of history that's older. I mean, even, you know, ancient in some regards, and actually researching as we are writing the pages of history and living into what will become history for future generations. And the sense that, you know, the 19th century and the fingerprints that left on, for example, people's understanding of the Restoration history or Mormonism is still so fresh with people, and they have definite understandings or preconceptions of what that's all about, for sure. So I know that you did an internship at the Community of Christ Kirtland Temple Historic Site. What can you tell us about that experience and how that kind of ties into what we're talking about today?
Yeah, Kirtland was, being in Kirtland for 3 months was really exciting for me, just because it does trace back so far into my own family history. I have a great, some number of greats aunt who's buried in the cemetery that's just north of the temple. And that's where my family, or at least part of my family, got into the church. I have a lot of pioneer stock that has nothing to do with the Joseph Smith era, but there's a little sliver of Kirtland and Nauvoo history that runs in my family. And so I really wanted, it was the first time that I'd ever been. If you grow up Mormon, typically if you're really into the church, as my parents really weren't, you tend to take these vacations to church history sites over the summer. Like, everybody does it, right? I didn't get that chance. I was the kid who was like, can we please road trip out to Kirtland and drive out to Palmyra and make our way back west? And my parents were like, no, we can't afford that. We've got 4 kids, and, you know, what are we going to do with the dogs, and how are we going to get there? Like, things like that. And we lived in California, and during the dot-com bust, my dad's into IT. So, at least he was at that point. And so it was like very financially not going to happen. So going to Kirtland last summer was my first time, and it was kind of my dream come true, because it was finally my opportunity, to retrace my family history and my church's history. But also, it's interesting because I was doing it from a new perspective as a recent convert to Community of Christ, the quote unquote apostate Mormons, as I grew up knowing about them. So what really interested me before that, but really came to a head in those 3 months, was this idea of interactions, cultural interactions between the factions, the quote unquote factions of the Restoration. So I've met Bickertonites, I've met polygamists, I've met plenty of Mormons, members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, as they are now requesting to be called, and, you know, a few Community of Christ members. And it's interesting to gauge their interests and to chronicle what they're interested in as far as church history goes. And that's what really fascinates me. I'm not interested so much in the facts and the things that have happened in the past. I'm interested more in how people have interacted with each other, both historically, and how that affects them today, and how people engage with what's happened in the 19th century. So I'm still kind of trying to figure out exactly where I want to take this as far as future studies. But I feel that there is really an untapped potential in Restoration Studies in looking at where each of these churches are culturally and sociologically. There's a lot of study on LDS populations because it's much larger. And, I mean, people come from Mormonism and from the LDS Church, and they go to BYU and they get their degrees in sociology, and they're interested in the same way that I am. They want to look back on their own culture and study it. But I feel like there's an interaction that's happening, and Kirtland is this place where it happens. Nauvoo is a place where it happens. Independence is a place where it happens, because I think most of the visitors to the temple in Independence are actually LDS, if I understand correctly. These are hot spots for interactions between each of the churches, and there's something happening there, because when people come away from those interactions, they take it home and they share it. And growing up LDS, I know that most people, every Mormon who's ever known somebody or gone to the Kirtland Temple has talked about how the Kirtland Temple has been stripped of the spirit because it's owned by that church and they don't understand what they have. And so being an intern and making this faith transition, I had the unique opportunity to answer a lot of those questions because people would notice that I was still wearing my garments. I still wear my garments sometimes from my LDS days because I take that endowment seriously. But I would talk to people, they would notice my garments or they would notice the way that I talk, the little social cues that people don't recognize as being cues from your background informs the way that you speak. And they would recognize that and they'd ask me questions and be like, "Are you Mormon?" I'd be like, "Yes, I'm fine. Ask me your questions." And so, I mean, at first it was really exciting and then it got a little exhausting, but just being that connection for people to ask the questions that they have that they've always wanted to ask somebody from Community of Christ, but are too afraid to. And I want to be part of something that makes a difference in the way that the churches communicate and interact culturally.
That's really intriguing. And as you describe the very unique situation you were in as far as your life experience, having been a recent convert to Community of Christ when you went to your internship in Kirtland, I'm really intrigued by the fact that members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints visiting Kirtland, obviously they picked up on the fact that culturally, you are a Mormon and you still speak that language, so to speak. And the idea that you open the door to allow them to ask the questions that they would be too afraid to ask or feel too awkward to ask a Community of Christ person. So, what were some of those questions they asked you?
First of all, they'd ask me what I was doing there, and then they'd be curious as to how Community of Christ would allow a Mormon on their interpreter team. And I mean, I would rarely tell people that I had converted because that I already know if I were to say that I recently joined Community of Christ, that would turn a lot of people off and they would walk away and they would talk about how that was so sad and they would pray for me or something like that. Just because I don't want that. I don't want that. And at the time I was still in a space of trying to make things work and practice in both and find the good and the authority and the revelatory power in both and the spiritual power. Because authority is very important to Mormons. And I wanted to honor that. And I mean, at the time, I think Thomas Monson was still alive and I still had this very, I admired him still. Mm-hmm. I felt I didn't want to betray that. And I still didn't feel comfortable with the idea of quote unquote betraying my parents. So I wouldn't tell people that I'd converted because I knew that that would shut the door on those questions. They would ask me, you know, what I was doing there, how I got in, like it's some big secret or it's some big, because Mormons are very secretive, right?
Right.
Not very secretive. It's like they expected it to be a sort of a ritual process or something, like how it, you know, have you left the church to do this? Are they the same as us where they have these worthiness interviews and how would you get past that? I got that's the sense that I got from that question. Just because Mormons are interested in worthiness and it's such a big, you have to have these interviews for every step that you want to take. I mean, to work at church headquarters, I was a janitor at the LDS Church headquarters in Salt Lake for a while, you have to be a temple recommend holding person, member of the church, to be a janitor or anything. So worthiness is huge for Mormons. And so the idea that I would be working for the Community of Christ implied that I wasn't worthy, or I was worthy in Community of Christ eyes, but maybe that meant that I wasn't worthy in an LDS sense. So that was a big question I got. Sometimes I would get questions along the lines of, what would Joseph Smith think of his son? What do you think he thought of his son joining a different church? And that question would just make me cringe because as part of this summer program, I took it upon myself to study the Smith family and, you know, very thoroughly and read several biographies of several of the members, just because I know that would be important to Mormons, because of this idea that this folkloric idea within Mormonism or the LDS church, the LDS culture, that Mormons believe that the community of Christ is based off of this idea that there was a faction or a part of the church during the succession crisis who believed that the prophetic power, the authority of the church should be dynastic instead of democratic. And I mean, that's really an oversimplification of what was happening, obviously. But that's where people I knew people would want to know about that dynasty, that Smith dynasty within Community of Christ, or that history. So I studied that and I got a lot of questions about that. Those are the only two that really stand out, is people would want to know what I'm doing there, how I got in, and then what impressions I have of the Smiths who are involved in this apostate church and why I think they went astray.
Very interesting. And just for the record, I want to make sure our listeners understand that Community of Christ very often has members of the LDS church and or LDS scholars who serve as interns at all of our historic sites. That's been a common practice for us. But I certainly can understand this cultural understanding of the criteria from an LDS perspective of what it would take to serve in their own experience of their own historic sites, and how that would just be like mind twisting to understand what was happening while you or others are doing that.
And part of that might actually also be, come to think of it, stems from the fact that Mormons in Mormon historic sites, or the sites owned by the LDS church, the guides are missionaries. Mm-hmm. So in LDS culture, that's somebody who has applied, who's gone through the worthiness process, who's been trained in a very specific way at the MTC in Provo. They have been prepared in a very particular way to share a very particular message at these sites. So the way that a Mormon might see it, if they encounter an LDS tour guide, as I was, I mean, kind of encountering that, it's like, wait a second. So you're a missionary, right? It's not, and missionaries in the LDS, it's not just giving a tour of a historic site. It's giving a tour of a historic site in the context of sharing doctrine and serving as a representative for a theology and a belief system that they want you, if you're not Mormon, to be curious about and to eventually investigate and potentially join into.
Yeah, so that's a real nuance of the culture, I think, with that missionary focus. And Community of Christ understanding of missionary is different as well. So always a sense of invitation. At our historic sites, there would be this sense of, you know, sharing culture, being very non-judgmental, but hospitable and welcoming and invitational for those who want to know more about Community of Christ. That's a really interesting difference there. Okay, so let's go a little bit deeper in these areas of restoration history and culture and sociology that are kind of like these pathways or trajectories of the two major denominations of the Restoration Movement, the LDS Church and Community of Christ, and how you see that being such a gold mine, so to speak, of understanding of how those movements went forward and lived out their faith.
I'll have to think about that for a minute. So basically, in the humanities, we have what we call, I mean, we have folklore, and it's a humanitarian discipline that's studied or understood by a lot of people who are in the humanities, historians, literature scholars, sociologists, anthropologists, etc. But folklore is sort of the dumpster of the humanities. We collect basically everything that nobody else wants. Or sometimes people approach it, and they do study things like fairy tales or narratives or traditions, holidays, things like that. Those are all folklore that can be studied from all these different perspectives. But as a folklorist, I'm studying artifacts from culture that are informal and traditional. So folklore is informal, traditional culture. That's a very basic understanding. It's funny that folklorists kind of look at the definition of folklore and kind of argue about it, which means that the definition of folklore in and of itself is folklore, because there are all these different ideas and different understandings. So we look at folklore, and we're not trying to prove anything. We're not trying to find the roots. Like a historian would look at the story of Cinderella and want to try to find the absolute source of that story. Whereas a literature scholar is going to look at the story of Cinderella and look at the meanings and the themes in Cinderella. A folklorist is going to look at Cinderella and say, how has this changed over time? And what did it mean to people in different cultures over time? And how does it get passed on? And why do we keep passing it on? And I like to look at folklore of the future and how folklore might change might change over time. And you can do this with fairy tales, food traditions. So if you're familiar with Utah cuisine at all, you've heard of Jell-O salad and funeral potatoes. And that's our foodway tradition. Or if you're more familiar with the South, you've got Southern comfort food. You've got jambalaya and gumbo. And I'm thinking Louisiana specifically because I serve there. And I love Louisiana. Fried chicken, or, you know, you get chili, different varieties of chili in Ohio. So you've got all these different traditions with food that really makes it folkloric, the way it gets passed down. That's folklore. Folklore is also the way that we tell stories within our families over time. So these family stories, and that's the history, right? That's history as folklore. So we have these stories and these ideas of how the world works that are passed down generation after generation. And within Mormonism, and I'm sure within RLDS, Now Community of Christ, or the Sidney Rigdon following, the Bickertonites, or polygamists, or any other group that's associated with Joseph Smith, they have very similar stories, if not the same stories. But the way that those stories are dispersed, and they may be history, but the way those stories are dispersed informally, meaning between people at church, not necessarily from a scholar, how those are dispersed says something about the culture and the values of a culture. So folklorists, within the field of folklore, there tend to be folklorists from three different religious backgrounds, at least in the United States. Folklore in Europe is very different. So I'm speaking specifically about American folklore. But most folklorists tend to come from Catholic, Jewish, or Mormon descent, which is interesting. You wouldn't expect that because Mormonism is such a small, you know, group of people within Christianity. But I think the reason for that is because these are highly ritualized customs and cultures. And there's an exclusivity about being Jewish or Mormon or even Catholic. I mean, I think Catholics are pretty laid back, but they're certainly like we have the Pope kind of vibe, right? Sometimes if you're super Catholic and living in a Catholic concentrated area, which I've never done. I don't actually know a whole lot of Catholics, but there's this sense of pride and a sense of, you can't call it nationalism, maybe religiousism, something like that, where you're very proud of your religion in a very grounding way. And I mean, for Jews, if you're Jewish, that's tied in with your ethnicity, right? Mm-hmm. So Catholicism and Mormonism aren't nearly as old as Judaism, but there could be a point in the future where we look at those communities as ethnic communities. And I, you know, in Mormonism, certainly you've got this surge of Northern Europeans who come into Utah, and a lot of them are coming from Norway, Denmark, Sweden, Scandinavian countries. So there is a precedence for this sort of ethnicity about Mormonism, even though it's a global church and there, you know, people from all over the world are members. There's, at least if you're in Utah, it's a very ethnically charged religion, very ethnically based religion and tradition. So having these layers, at least folklore is in itself a study of the different layers of culture. And I don't know, I don't believe that there have been too many folklorists who've really looked at how the folklore and the way that we tell stories in other traditions compares to the LDS experience. There's plenty out there about LDS folklore from folklorists such as Austin and Alta Fife, Bert Wilson, Wayland Hand. These are people who come out of Mormonism and study Mormonism, but nobody's studying anybody else. There's a little bit of study about polygamy because it, you know, derives out of that Brighamite, Utah Mormonism, but nobody's looking at the Midwest. Nobody's looking at Pennsylvania. Who is left outside of the Brigham Young section of the church of Mormonism? So that's what I'm really interested in, is looking at that and seeing how it interacts with this larger group. Because I remember as a kid, my grandparents actually lived in the neighborhood behind the Community of Christ building in Salt Lake. And so whenever we would visit Utah, we would drive by it. And I would always notice the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And I always thought, well, what are they doing here? How dare they come to Utah and think that they have a place to stand? but it's always stuck with me that they're there. That presence, I can't help but imagine that a lot of people look at that and they're thinking the same thing. And we know it's there. Mormons are aware that that these churches exist, but nobody really thinks to consider that they have cultures and beliefs and ideas about Joseph Smith or the Book of Mormon or the succession crisis or even the pioneers or any of that. Nobody considers that they have views or ideas or how they internalize doctrines, ideas that come out of that era in their culture, in their own way. And I see it all the time when I'm engaging with Community of Christ or talking with people in Community of Christ or learning more about Community of Christ. I notice that I see exactly how the history of Joseph Smith and what was happening in Kirtland and Nauvoo. And I see how that is reflected through the culture. And even if Community of Christ is moving away from that history, you can't escape the fact that that history still informs the way that you engage with people. And it all comes from the same place as the ideas that people in the LDS Church, how they internalize that. It's all the same source, but the way that that information is dispersed and the way that that's lived out is so different. That's what I really want to see. And I don't think that we're doing enough to really analyze what's going on. Because if the restoration is still alive and it's still happening, I say that, and that's going to mean something very different to a Mormon than it is to a member of Community of Christ. But still, it's a phrase that you could say in either community. It's going to mean something. If that's still happening, I think it's time we need to look at how it affects the broader spectrum and start using that as a means to build bridges, at both culturally and ecumenically, and help people understand each other to heal a lot of those wounds that historically have existed for a long time. And I know that's happening from the top down. There are articles all the time here in Salt Lake. Whenever an apostle or somebody comes and talks to the church officials here in Utah, so an apostle from Community of Christ or somebody comes here to talk to an LDS leader, it's headline news here in Utah. So I know that that's happening, but culturally, it's not. There's still a long distance that people want to hold on to, and they want to keep that separation. I mean, my own family, my parents are pretty open to me being a member of whatever community I want to be. I mean, at one time I was atheist, so they're just happy for me to believe in God again. But there are times when I get these little social cues from them that they feel betrayed culturally, because it's almost worse in a sense that I'm Community Christ rather than an atheist, because I look at my sister and she's an atheist and doesn't go to church and lives with her boyfriend out of wedlock and all of that. And they're pretty upset with that, but it's like, why am I getting the flack for believing in God, but just in a different way now? So I want to build those bridges so that people don't feel this, especially for people who are making the transition, because there's a sense of that you're betraying your culture. Mm-hmm. And I imagine that people who convert from Community Christ to the Mormon Church, because I've met some, I would expect that that's the same thing for them. Making that faith transition between the churches that have the same basis and foundation in historically, that's really hard. And I want to fix that so that doesn't have to be a problem.
That's really interesting. You've said so many things that I want to ask you more questions about. But also, I just want to stop for a minute and acknowledge as you're talking that just looking at the LDS trajectory and the RLDS trajectory, that both came out of that early period of common history with a firm belief that we are the one true church. And that was lived out in both expressions for well over 100 years. And it's taken a lot of work on Community of Christ part to pause and reflect on that and peel that apart, as at the same time we were understanding how God is calling us to be the church in the world today. And when I say the church, to be a faithful reflection of Jesus Christ and the message of the gospel in the 21st century, and coming to an understanding that being exclusive in any sense was, for us, was not a faithful reflection of the whole message of Jesus. And yet we still, because that, from a historian's point of view, that's fairly recent history. We still carry the fingerprints of that culturally, for sure. And I think what you said about the fact that it may well be difficult for a Community of Christ when one of our own converts to the LDS Church, that's a similar experience as you describe, you know, in your own family, even though they're very happy for you to be living out a Christian faith, that at the same time, there's a little bit of a bite in that because of that culture. Mm-hmm. So I want to ask you a little bit, when you're talking about folklore and how that's passed on, I'm hearing a very strong sense that folklore also shapes and forms the culture as it continues to unfold and emerge. And what I'm wondering is, how do influences or events impact culture that come from an outside influence, so to speak? So, for example, maybe some catastrophic, you know, earthquake or something would be an outside influence that we can't control, or maybe war or something happening on a larger scale outside of our culture or tribe or group of people. How does that impact folklore, and how do you see that impacting specifically the LDS path and Community of Christ path?
So this idea of, I mean, going back to this example of the one true church narrative, that's not really something that's doctrine. I don't see it at all in, I mean, there's maybe a little of that kind of growing out of Joseph Smith's era. There are people who would know far better than I would, whether it's the case or not, but I don't really see that as being a concentration in the earliest days. I think it comes down to the succession crisis and who has the proper authority. And really, the succession crisis isn't even really this moment in time. It happens over several years because it doesn't really come to a head or finalize until Joseph Smith III makes his choice in where he wants to be. So I think the one true church thing really develops over that time period. You have Joseph Smith looking at different things. I think if I remember correctly, he was interested in Islam and the Quran and whether Muhammad could have been a prophet of God, which is super revolutionary. Especially, the United States has always had culturally this impression of Islam as being this backwoods Middle Eastern, traitors against Christianity, this holdover from European Christianity and the Crusades, right? So they have this negative attitude towards Islam, where Joseph Smith is kind of like, maybe there's something to this Muhammad guy. Maybe there's something to this. So I don't think that Joseph Smith really would have looked at what he was doing as being setting up the one true church. I think that really comes out of this identity crisis that people are having to reconcile with between the factionalization of Joseph's church. So that as a piece of folklore, this folk idea, it carries over for a long time, like you said. And I think there have been certain things in the historical trajectories of both churches that change that, right? Communion of Christ has always been a church based in society, surrounded by other people. And I think a crisis probably came at some point, and I don't know Communion of Christ's history nearly as well as I do Mormon history, or history from the LDS perspective. But because they're situated in the Midwest and they're surrounded by other churches, other cultures, people coming in, moving in and settling the area, Joseph Smith III grows up with that. Members of that, the people who stayed behind, they recognize that they need to settle down and they need to make peace with Missouri, with Hancock County, and settle in and become part of this broader society. Whereas Brigham Young takes people and goes west to Utah, where nobody else wants to be. And he settles down and they self-isolate. So this idea, this folk idea of the one true church can only last so long in Communion of Christ, whereas in the LDS church, it can last for a long time. And Communion of Christ met with that. It's not necessarily like a cataclysmic event, but over time, it just got chipped away at. This idea was chipped away at because obviously, guys, there are people here in Nauvoo or in Iowa or in Missouri or wherever you are in the Midwest who are great people who aren't members of our church. And we kind of need to get over it. That's the impression that I get looking at even Joseph III's expectations and for himself, for his people then, but maybe what he was hinting at in the way that he approached the future and what he wanted the church to be. I don't think it was going to last very long, this idea of being the one true church in the RLDS narrative. Whereas in Mormonism, we are facing a cataclysmic event in the LDS church right now. They haven't really it's not been a chipping away at that. Utah is still predominantly LDS. Salt Lake is the least Mormon. Well, maybe Summit County is, because Park City is full of like California, vacation, mm-hmm. winter vacation homes. But it's getting there to that point where there are more non-Mormons in Utah, and yet Mormonism still dominates. Right now, there's a big argument going on and a big to-do about medical marijuana and Prop 2, which the church has come out against, even though I'm for it. Well, yes, I think that medical marijuana should be legal in Utah, but the church has come out and said, well, we need more research. We support medical marijuana, but this. And whatever the church says, we'll go. Mitt Romney has moved to Utah to run for Senate specifically because he knows he will win it. It has nothing to do with how well he represents the people, the mindset, the ideas, because people here are actually far more conservative than Mitt Romney is, but they will still vote for him because he's a member of the one true church. He's a member of the one true faith. And so the church isn't challenged. The culture is not challenged. And this is, I mean, Mormonism is everywhere. You can find Mormons all around the globe, but for some reason, it's still led by people who are from this culture in Utah, and they're informed by this culture. The hierarchy will function as though they're still boys living on an Idaho farm or a Utah farm or ranch or whatever. And they haven't had that cataclysmic event yet that would affect folklore in the way, or this folk idea in the way that it has for King of Christ.
Yeah, I think what you say about those saints that went west and being geographically isolated, which meant they became, in a sense, culturally isolated, had such an impact on those who went west and also those who stayed behind, who basically had to learn how to live in community with a diverse group of folks in Middle America. And as the RLDS Church grew across the U.S. and in other countries, I think we were able for a period of time to continue that sense of, you know, the true priesthood restored to the earth, the one true church, the authority of priesthood, not just in that way, but clinging to this succession, the dynasty type of approach to the restoration movement. And then in the 60s, when we really got into going into other countries, specifically countries that were not Christian, trying to share the message of the gospel as one true church with people who have no understanding of Christianity, really was a pivotal event in the life of the reorganized church, and soul searching and digging deeper as to, you know, we are first and foremost the Church of Jesus Christ, and not being able to deny, as you talked about, you know, looking at the people we lived with in Middle America and recognizing the good of these people, that we could not deny the presence of God in all the people we were meeting across the planet, and having that turn that whole thing on its ear, so to speak. Yeah, it's amazing to me how isolation from others does so much to how people sociologically and culturally develop as time goes on. And go ahead.
Wait, well, I just want to add to that, which is why that shift with Community of Christ, it is this effect from being in the world and always being in the world.
Mm-hmm.
For the LDS Church, that event that changes them, if it's ever going to change from being the one true church narrative, that's going to have to come from within. And it's happening, but it's starting to happen, but there's a resistance from the top down. And there have been periods where it's almost, you know, that's always been happening. But right now it just seems like every time there's this potential, it's like a mini earthquake that's leading up to a big one.
Mm-hmm.
And every time you get closer to that big earthquake, the mini earthquakes get a little bigger themselves. So there have been periods where the LDS Church has faced this sort of cataclysmic event that would tear apart that narrative. But right now it feels like this might be the shakings of the event that really tears down that piece of folklore in the LDS culture.
I really appreciate all the things you're helping us understand more deeply about folklore, and also this interconnectedness of folklore and culture, which is very fascinating. And then these layers of, as we talk about religion and the restoration movement specifically, but these layers of folklore and history and doctrine, and for restoration movements, this sense of revelation, ongoing revelation from God, and of course in Community of Christ, that's recorded in the Doctrine and Covenants, and just this interplay of these things, and obviously many other factors as well. I find it just fascinating. So Megan, as you look to the future, what are some of your hopes for future studies or research, and what your research might actually reveal to us? How might that inform us?
Well, I don't know that, I'm not sure what it would reveal. I'm not like a prophet. But I'm hoping to take a lot of these ideas that we've talked about and base them in historical research, because as an academic, you need to have that credible research. And I might have ideas, but I don't have the credibility or the academic backing to say, oh yeah, what I'm saying is totally the truth. And these are just ideas that I've been thinking about for a long time that I want to dig deeper on and find means to share with people. I'm in the process of doing research for a couple of folkloric studies more historically based things, like women in Kirtland. There's this tendency when we look at Mormon history, to especially Mormon women history, we overlook the fact that women have culture themselves, and women are more than just sexual objects. When we look at Mormon history, we tend to look at the polygamy side of things all the time, and we don't look at what else is going on, really. We don't look at anything outside the household, which is difficult. I mean, women were, in the 19th century, they were in homes, and that's what they were doing. But I still would like to see this shift away from polygamy studies. I'm so sick of hearing about polygamy. I'd rather look at what women were doing in Kirtland, which is difficult. There's not a whole lot of information, but I think it'd be valuable to try to make that shift by looking at what they were doing before polygamy happened. And there's a lot of stuff that's going on with Kirtland, both historically and really my focus in folklore. There's a lot happening with the Kirtland narrative and women in Kirtland narrative that I think is pretty fascinating. So I'm working on some research for that. And really, as far as what I want to do, it just kind of comes when I encounter things. So I like to collect more rumors and stories of interactions between at least Community of Christ and the LDS Church for right now, just because I know more people in those. Eventually I'd like to extend it to other groups. But looking at the rumors that they hold of each other, and how they compare. In folklore, there's a folklorist named Linda Turner. She theorized this idea that it's called the Topsy-Eva effect, and it's named after the doll in Uncle Tom's Cabin. And it was a popular doll in the 19th century, but it's a doll that when you turn it over on one side, it will be a white doll. If you turn it over to the other side, it's a black doll. And her idea with this theory and this reflection in using this term is that we often have rumors in competing cultures, and she looks at it from a ethnically based cultures. We have the same rumors, the exact same stories, but depending on who's telling it, it's going to be about the other side. So if it's a black person telling a rumor, it's going to be about the white side, and it's going to demonize the white culture. If it's a white person telling the rumor, it's going to demonize the black side, the black community. And I think that there's probably a lot of that happening between the LDS and more RLDS. I'm going to say RLDS because I think it's rooted in that identity as RLDS. There's a lot of that probably happening, or at least I believe it's probably going to happen, if any indication from my childhood and hearing those rumors is true, then I'm sure that's happened in the RLDS culture before Community of Christ. So I want to collect those kinds of rumors and stories that people are telling about the other church, the other side, and compare those and how they compare.
That all sounds really interesting, Megan, and I am looking forward to reading what you publish in the future, and I certainly hope that you will begin to write research papers along the way and share them at venues like the John Whitmer Historical Association and Mormon History Association, and Sunstone, of course, is right there in Salt Lake every summer, because this is fascinating, just fascinating. So I have a question for you, because I know there are other young adults who want to go deeper in their studies along similar paths. So what advice might you have for other young adults who want to go into studies of their own? And are there places for people to connect with others who have similar interests?
Yeah. I think the problem that young people face right now is that there's still a lot of interest in liberal arts education, but there's not a whole lot of opportunity career-wise. And so I think millennials and Gen Z, or the iGeneration, we have to be a little bit more creative in how we can play out those desires. And I think that talking to a lot of younger people closer to my age, there's a little bit more of an intersectionality happening in their thought processes. So it's not just, let's study the history, let's analyze the history, let's write a book. It's more about, well, what's in this for me? What's in this for now? How is history reflecting on, or how is now reflecting on history? How does the past interact with the present? And I think that's probably true for a lot of millennials or younger people looking to get into these studies. And personally, I'm trying to figure it out myself. But I think what I'm trying to do is get into networking, connect with people online, watch the conversation. And I tend to just kind of lurk online and watch other people have conversations. But there are plenty of Facebook groups who are actively engaging in these conversations. And you do have to if you're LDS, it's going to be a stretch because, you know, going on to Feminist Mormon Housewives is maybe a little dangerous if you're a believing LDS member. But if you're Community of Christ and you want to get engaged in these things, start engaging with the other side, whatever church you belong to, get involved and talk to people on the other side of things. Join Facebook groups. Exist on Facebook. There are, of course, the Latter-day Seekers groups for anybody who's LDS looking at Community of Christ and wanting to ask questions. There's Community of Christ Dialogue if you want to talk about Community of Christ things. One of the groups I really enjoy is the Mormon Transhumanist Association. Their group is called Mormon Transhumanism. And if that's sort of taking the idea of the doctrine that we will become gods from an LDS perspective, that we can become as God and be gods, and saying, well, this is scientifically, from an evolutionary theoretical standpoint, this is absolutely going to happen. Maybe not us personally, but eventually humanity will transcend into immortality and become gods themselves. So it's kind of this idea that prophecy is playing itself out. So there's a lot of interesting conversation going on there. Feminist Mormon Housewives is great. The Restoration Exploration Forum, Exponent 2, these are more based in LDS culture. There's of course also the Community of Christ Millennials page. That's a good place to talk to people. It's not super active right now, I think, because millennials are having this faith crisis as it is. Nobody's really talking. But I think that the millennials who do want to continue on with religion and trying to reshape organized religion, that's a place to start conversations. And how do we make this relevant for us going into the future? So get online, get on Facebook. There are plenty of pages out there, plenty of groups. And one thing that I'm doing is trying to be as involved as possible in maybe not presenting, but attending conferences. So I'm going to be at the John Whitmer Historical Association conference in September in Independence. Sunstone in Salt Lake, of course. And Sunstone actually does have groups that meet up all across the world. There's Sunstone Europe, there's Sunstone Seattle, there's Sunstone Kirtland, Nauvoo. They do various events across the world, and especially in the United States. So just get involved and start talking to people. Sometimes people scare me because I'm an introvert, but generally they don't bite. And a lot of people, especially if they've been looking at these kinds of things for years, you know, a lot of people are settled and they have their niche group of studies. But I think the hard thing or the intimidating thing about this, and I mean, I've been interested in Mormon history since I was, you know, since I could read. As soon as I learned how to read, I'd go to the library at school and pick up any book I could about Mormons and the paranormal, which is, you know, if that tells you anything, I'm really geared towards being a folklorist instead of a historian, because I love the paranormal too. And I mean, just growing up in that, with that interest and trying to think, well, everybody's written everything, you know, history's done. I don't need it anymore. I think looking at history from a cultural perspective, that still needs to be done. And I think there's a huge opportunity there for people who are interested in looking at that. So consider cultural studies and just getting involved in networking with people and talking with people. And it's hard. It's not easy. I'm definitely struggling with it too, but I think that's the best advice I can give.
So while we're on the topic of talking with people, if you could talk to anyone who lived during the early days of the Restoration Movement, sit down, have a cup of coffee, whatever, who would it be and why would you pick them?
I'm going to be totally selfish here. I would actually probably sit down with one of my ancestors who lived through from Kirtland all the way to Nauvoo, one of them being Sarah Harmon. Her sister, I think it's her sister who's buried in the cemetery in Kirtland. And again, this is for selfish reasons, because I really want to know what it's like to be a woman. And I guess this does go back to polygamy and why we need to like get out of it. But what it is to be a woman, to be part of Kirtland, that temple building, fledgling church, you know, just trying to pull itself out of this squalor and this big mess that's happening financially in the church, going from that to moving to Nauvoo and maybe hearing these rumors. I don't think she ever ended up in Missouri, but hearing these or seeing what's happened in Missouri and hearing these rumors of polygamy with your prophet and seeing all of these new people coming in and then making that choice to go west with Brigham Young and having happen what happens in Utah. Why did she, like, what compels a person to stay in Utah? I guess Utah is gorgeous, but personally, like, if I didn't live in a city in Utah, I would have been on a wagon back east in a heartbeat, because it's so much easier now, but there are days where I'm just like, I don't know that I could live here if I could stay here. And again, I guess it's that mindset of, you know, what informs you folklorically, what is your identity culturally, and how devoted are you to that? I think the reason why we can sort of take these things apart now is because we're in an identity crisis as humans, and we aren't really attached to any identity. So now we're deconstructing all that, right? Well, and that's why we have this postmodern deconstructive trend that's going on and has been going on for years now. But how does she end up doing all of that? And what does that all look like to her looking back? So, and what does that have to do with me? How, you know, I just have maybe all of her children up until me, just all of us we can talk and talk about what kept us in Mormonism in the LDS church, and what all of our thoughts have been on those who stayed behind.
I like that. I'm going to look to see Sarah Harmon in the pages of history. So you say her grave is in
I think it's her sister or her aunt. I can't remember. But her name was Naomi Harmon, daughter of, and actually her grave is unmarked, but I know it's there, and I know where it is, because it's marked on a little map that Ron Romig gave to me. So I know kind of where it is.
That is very interesting. So the last thing is, sometimes we have listeners that want to read up more on this topic right away when they hear something fascinating on Project Zion podcast. So are there any resources that you might recommend to listeners who want to look up and read some more right after they get done listening to this podcast or sometime this week?
If people are interested in folklore and just learning a little bit more about folklore, specifically just the discipline, or more broadly the discipline, I would highly recommend the book Folklore Rules, A Fun, Quick, and Useful Introduction to the Field of Academic Folklore Studies by Lynn McNeil. She is a professor at Utah State. I never got to take one of her classes, but she's amazing, and she's been featured on a couple of TV shows. But that book is like 88 pages. I use it in my own teaching, and it just kind of goes over what folklore is and how it affects our lives, and it's really easy to read. And Lynn's great. So I would highly recommend that book. The other book, if you are more interested in LDS folklore and what's out there, one book I would recommend, I haven't read through all of it. I've perused it because it's a really kind of a big read. And of course, there's nothing that really exists for Community of Christ or any of the other groups. But one book that's out right now is called Latter-day Lore, Mormon Folklore Studies. And that's edited by Eric A. Eliason and Tom Mould. I'd also look at you could Google William A. Wilson. He was a prolific folklorist who I've mentioned already, but he focused a lot on Utah folklore and West Intermountain West folklore that also deals with LDS people. And those, so the Latter-day Lore and William A. Wilson's work is going to be pretty academically dense. But if you're interested in more of that, that would be the place to go. Or if you just want a basic introduction, look at Lynn's book. It's great. It's easy to read. And it can give you a little bit more information on folklore.
Thank you for that, Megan. And thank you so much for being with us today on Project Zion Podcast. Listeners, don't forget, Megan will also be featured on Fair Trade with her faith transition story. And our series, Chai Can't Even, where millennials talk about faith and their life today. Thank you for listening to Project Zion Podcast. This is your host, Robin Linkhart, signing off, and we'll see you next time. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Project Zion Podcast. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or whatever podcast streaming service you use, and while you are there, give us a 5-star rating. Project Zion Podcast is sponsored by Latter-day Seeker Ministries of Community of Christ. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Latter-day Seeker Ministries or Community of Christ. The music has been graciously provided by Dave Hines.